The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talking Monkeys, the official podcast of 12 Monkeys. I am your host, Clark Wolf. It is so nice to talk to you all again. Here we are, episode 3, starting off the season strong, and we have a crazy exciting group of guests here. We have some returning guests, of course, our co-creator and showrunner, Terry Metalis.
Hi.
And we have the one and only Mr. Aaron Stanford.
Hello.
And joining us this week, we do not have Amanda Scholl this week, unfortunately. She's time traveling. But we do have Mr. Todd Stashwick. Hello, sir.
Good day.
And we have Sean Tretta. And Sean, you are a writer on the show.
I am, yes.
We are so happy to have you here. And you actually wrote the second episode of this season, yes?
I did, yes.
Well, we enjoyed it very much.
Sean, Thank you. To be fair, writes on all of them a lot. We are big sausage factory as far as everybody who differs.
What?
It's a,
I mean, it takes a picture of that room.
It's a horrible.
It is kind of a,
a visual.
It can be a sausage fest from time to time.
It can be, but everybody.
Lock the doors.
There's a little bit of everybody spread out and splashed across every episode.
Well,
is that gross enough?
It's getting more and more
yeah,
graphic.
Yeah. Last time we had our
basically we make our mark.
Sausages splash.
We all mark our territory.
It just totally changed my job description.
Well, actually, Terry, you know, in addition to marking your territory, a lot of times, you know, people love getting inside with TV shows and finding out about the process. Can you real quick explain how a writer's room would work, or how, you know, you have one writer on one episode, but everybody kind of contributes?
Yeah, I mean, everybody runs a writer's room a little bit different, and how people, you know, put together a script is a little bit different. For me, I think everybody has some superpowers, and it's worth having a lot of voices in one script. Whether that would be somebody who can write a Jennifer scene better than I can in that moment, when I'm like, you know, I'm really focused on getting Ramsey and Cole doing their thing. I don't know if I could get a great Jennifer scene, so I need some help on that. And someone will write a scene, and then I can come in and rewrite or whatever, or not. Sean has been from the very beginning a very, very important voice in the show. It's a hard show to get to understand the time travel complexity of it all. And the emotion. So I lean on Sean quite a bit. We're in sync quite a bit. And that's not to say there's, you know, Richard Robbins is another one, Travis Fickett, who I created the show with. There's a shorthand on specific things that is, I think it's valuable to have everybody on a script. So.
And Sean, did you write on season one as well?
I did. I wrote two episodes, The Keys and Shonen.
Okay.
And,
that's your favorite. Isn't Shonen your favorite?
I do love that episode. Yeah. I really like season one a lot. I like season two. I just like the show.
It turned out great. I mean, it's a load of fun. Like, you know, each season starts and we basically are in the room banging our heads against the table, fighting and arguing. And that's probably the most stressful, but also the most fun time because you're blue skying everything. And it's a great job to have.
I will say, though, there was one particular moment that Sean, in the second episode, you know, we're going to get to episode 3 in a second, but in the second episode where we changed time, where we actually burned the virus, that happened, and I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast last time, I'm not sure. I went on a hike for a 2-hour hike in the morning, and I'm like, we really need a victory. We really need to kind of move past the plague. We need to reset this thing. And I came in, I don't know if you remember that morning, and I was like, we're going to burn the plague, and we're going to change time. And we then had an 8-hour time travel argument about whether or not that was a good idea or not.
Yeah.
And Sean was pretty much remaining silent the whole time.
It was a, It was a very lonely day for me.
The whole time. And then finally I looked over at him and he was just smiling and nodding. And like, he got it. He's like, this is what we have to do. And we still weren't sure. I mean, I walked out of that meeting being like, I'm not entirely sure. I ran it by, I called Natalie. I'm like, Natalie Chaidez, who was on last season. She's working on Hunters. I'm like, let me just throw this idea. She's like, no, it's too crazy. It's too complicated. I don't know. We ultimately, we didn't go with it. We decided it might be too complicated. And then we happened to be on a pitch call at the studio. And I looked at Sean and I was like, what the hell? I'm going to pitch. I'm going to do it. And we did. And they were like, you got to do that.
Yeah.
So it was great.
Yeah. So we took it out. And then when we're talking to the execs, they're like, and then we get to this moment. It'd be really great if something big happened. Our eyes lit up like, yes, now we can do this thing we wanted to do. And we kind of didn't look back after that.
And now here we are in episode 3. We find ourselves in 1944,
yes,
which is ambitious to say the least. And
yes,
I'm really excited that we got a chance to not only, I think we're going to spend a little time in 1944 in this episode and maybe some future episodes.
It does seem like they're stuck there.
It sure does, doesn't it? So let's dive in if that works for you guys. We start the episode with these two messengers essentially murdering these this army gentleman and his date, I suppose. They're about to go to this dance and they assume their identity in order to get in and access this
military function.
Yes, this military function. So, you know, there's not a lot of dialogue in this opening sequence, but there is a lot of action, and obviously the mood is set and these things are communicated really quickly something bad is about to go down. For you guys, for our writers who are here, how is it playing in the 1944 sandbox?
It's amazing.
Well, I think, wasn't that really one of the first times we opened an episode
in the past,
POV that was not our characters?
Yeah.
And that was the interesting thing. It's like, we're gonna start with these people that our audience doesn't know. And how well are they going to follow that? And are they engaged with them?
Yeah, and hopefully people remembered Scottie Thompson from the first episode when she jumps away and that moment she has with Cassie as she looks, as they kind of give each other a look that definitely suggests they're going to meet again. It was to open up the show with a big mystery.
Yes, mission accomplished. Okay,
yeah.
So we're back in 2044, Dr. Eklund has moved out, so Jonesy's, I don't know why I called her Jonesy, like I know her.
He calls her Jonesy,
doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jonesy.
So Jones's boyfriend has moved out. There's trouble in paradise there, which we'll get to later. But we're noticing some anomalies with the timeline, with the machine. There's problems with time travel, and we get into those later. But, you know, I think this is kind of the beginning of Jones sort of losing her cool a little bit, yeah?
She's definitely thrown. She's not sure what the messengers wanted with the machine, where they went. There are these new anomalies that are appearing in the time stream. She's starting to come undone. And it's no longer just a straightforward go back and kill the guy who created a virus issue. It seems to be really complicated.
Sure. And so after that, you know, we're still there in the facility, and Cole and Deacon are fighting hard with each other as Ramsey sort of looks on. First of all, which it was just kind of funny to me. He's like, he's clearly enjoying this. But for you guys, you know, when you're in that fight sequence, looked really brutal. So kudos to the stunt team, to you guys, to the way they shot it. I mean, it looks great. Can you talk a little bit about when you have those physical fight scenes, you know, how much you guys prepare, how much you do, how much your stunt team does?
There's very little time to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
We shoot this thing at breakneck pace. So most of the time for something like that, a fight like that, you're lucky if you come in and you get, you know, maybe 10 minutes to sort of go over the choreography.
Wow.
and run through it. But you really get it, the more you do, the easier it gets. I don't want to make it sound harder than it is.
It very much is a dance.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They walk you through it. So I would rehearse it with his stunt double. He would rehearse it with my stunt double. And then we would rehearse it together. And then they put down the mats and they shoot it in pieces.
That's one of the things that makes it manageable at all, is that you can, that they'll do like a wide where you have to go through the whole thing, but for the most part, for the details, you can break it down into one action at a time. So,
but we did do the whole thing from beginning to end quite a bit, yep. And it was fun, and they certainly found interesting ways to use that tiny space for that fight. Yeah, those guys are good.
It looked really harsh. It looked great. So good job, team.
From a story point, I think it was really important to show this, like to be like, they are not going to get along just because Deacon is in this in the facility now. That, and I thought it was important to just get to it. It's the first thing you hear is a punch, and this is the new normal, and then you get a little bit of Cassie and Deacon.
Yes. And so before I get to that, Todd, a couple of episodes ago on this podcast, when we saw Deacon sort of being brought into the fold, into the facility, he's sort of part of this team, I guess out of necessity, but also he's functioning in the facility. Like, I was surprised because Deacon was kind of cray cray last season.
Quite a bit.
And now here we are. So did you feel, just to start, like your character has gone through some sort of arc or evolution since we saw him in season one?
You know, we had talked about it actually when we were shooting the season finale of season one, about how we might be bringing Deacon into the fold. And so it was kind of advantageous that we had these conversations prior to actually shooting episode 13, so that we could weave in moments of his kind of change of heart, where
his doubt,
where there's a few key specific moments. I think there's a moment where he watches the blue man kind of go to town on a guy in a hallway with a knife, and he's like, oh, anybody's disposable to these guys. Deacon, as our saying, is like, Deacon's nuts, but these guys are crazy. Mm-hmm. And then there was the moment when they start talking about the cycles, and they start doing their pseudo-religious speak. He's like, okay, they're absolutely off the ranch, and I'm going to side with the humaner people, because I still want this place. And I think that's his prime motivation, is to provide a decent roof over the head of the West Side.
I think it's all there in that last scene with Deacon, mm-hmm. where Rayleigh comes through, when he says to Jones, okay, you're coming with me.
Yeah,
there's a level of, these guys are crazy. Mm-hmm. Let's just get out of this room right now.
Yeah,
and then I also like that the first thing he asks her is about Cole, too, because Deacon has this focus on Cole, which I think is really interesting.
And we lean into that
a
little bit this season as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You learn a little bit more about why that might be.
And then the first time we see him in the episode one, and he lays his eyes on a conscious Rayleigh, you see a moment of recognition. You see a moment of potential fanboy. Like, you see a flash across his face of newness, freshness, of a feeling he hasn't really experienced in the apocalypse.
Yeah. Well, so to that point, you know, because Cassie comes in and we see it's Deacon protecting Cassie in that moment. And I was
quote
just,
unquote, protecting.
But yeah, exactly. You know, but that's absolutely right. And so,
looming.
Of course, we've got you two, you know, Cole and Deacon kind of at odds. And of course, this is, I'm assuming, news to Cole, like, oh, we're doing this now. So, you know, can you guys talk a little bit about putting that I almost said love triangle. I think that's a little too much, but putting that triangle into play in this situation for not the first time, but.
Well, you know, first of all, Cole's been, you know, sort of learning all these new things about Cassie and how she's changed and who she's become. And this is yet one more thing to add to that pile that just sort of really kind of shakes his understanding of who this person is. And also it answers some questions as to where she's been getting some of the rhetoric that she's been spouting and this new sort of kill happy attitude.
Yeah, she says, let him live, create an enemy.
Yeah.
Right.
Call
back. Yeah. Tagline.
Indoctrinated. And I think Cole,
like, you're paying attention
in that moment. He sees, like, this is what's been going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
and how about you, Todd?
Well, I think Deacon, he's been there. Mm-hmm. Like, he's been there for the better part of a year in the facility. And he's been the, I mean, look, Jones is the big dog in that facility. But in terms of the muscle, that's what Deacon has been. And that's his power base. And that's, he's the leader of that army that's keeping that place safe. And then suddenly Cole comes back in, and Cole was very much the big dog there aside from Jones. And I think, so that is already threatening him. He's also, he also likes to poke at Cole. Mm-hmm. Like, he has always liked to push Cole. He's always liked to test Cole. And this is just another, so the fight, in many ways, if you watch it with pause on, I'm smiling my way through it. He's having a blast. Mm-hmm. It's a spar for him in as much as it is a legitimate throwdown. Like, if they really wanted to hurt each other bad, they would have. I think it's a getting out of aggression. It's a getting out of a reestablishment. They're kind of peeing in the corners of the.
It's space. Definitely territorial pissings. Yeah. I was just about to say that they're definitely both trying to stake a claim. You can
right,
tell.
And then when she comes in the room, it just raises those stakes even more.
Well, I would like to ask you, Todd, and then I would like to ask our writers, and in this moment, currently, is Cassie and Deacon's relationship romantic? In this moment.
In this scene. Well,
you know what? Let me just.
Yeah.
Is anything really romantic on this show? Is there really time for now? That doesn't mean there isn't a connection or an attraction or an experience.
Chemistry.
There's time for desire.
Yes.
There's time for what?
There's time for people to desire that.
Yeah. So. It's hard to classify anything as romantic.
Well,
strumming ukuleles on a canoe.
I was about to say, obviously, I'm not talking flowers and candy.
It's clear that there's a bond that we're not sure how deep that bond goes for either one of them, and that they've had 8 months together.
They are protective of each other. There is a mutual need for each other. For whatever those needs are.
Are we getting into some spoilery territory
here? We don't want to get spoilers, but I'm just talking about, like, in this current situation. I know it's hard because we have a lot of timelines going on.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. I think we said that last
that
time.
That would be our Facebook status. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. That's what Amanda said. It's complicated. It's complicated with everyone. All right. Artfully dodged by all the men of 12 Monkeys. I will move on. Typical men. Don't want to call it what it is.
Why you got to give it a label, Clark?
Can we just hang out?
Bigger fish to fry in the apocalypse.
All right. Certainly. Moving on. So they have this photo of Cole and Cassie from 1944. Ramsey recognizes the photo, which
the writing on the back.
Which was kind of telling and interesting. And then, of course, we learn about Thomas Crawford being murdered. So. This sets all this in motion. There's also, Cassie doesn't want to go back. She doesn't want to go to 1944, but Jones seems pretty adamant, like, you kind of have to go. We need you to go. But she uses, you know, she says it's a world at war. And she says that phrase, a world at war, when talking about the time period, was used a lot in this episode and maybe even in the following episode. So I wanted to ask our writers, you know, it just seemed funny to me that coming from 2044, you know what I mean, in the apocalypse, and they're talking about the war. So can you guys sort of talk a little bit? Exactly.
Well, I mean, I think they're talking about the security of getting into this event, that being a different time. And, you know, we look at each of these time periods as very distinct things. So that's what she's talking about. It's like, you know, the rules of life were different here. You can navigate 2015 fine, but 1940 something is going to be very difficult for you. It's not what you think it is.
It's a bit more paranoid too, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody, you know, everything is occupied by this war. You know, it's all anybody's talking about. So I think it's a different world to navigate. There's not enough. Not everybody's distracted. Like Cole going back to 2016, he might not stick out because you're probably on your iPhone checking Twitter. But 1944 with that beard, Yeah. It's harder.
And that's some, you know, it's little details like that. Like, he would be clean shaven. So in the episode, we had to address that. And, you know, there's different periods of time that have different social rules too. And we address that a lot this season, mm-hmm. and will more. In subsequent episodes.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and so as they splinter, you know, Cole and Cassie's relationship is absolutely still strained. You know, I even wrote down in my notes, Cassie plus Deacon equals romantic. So.
Oh, my God.
So clearly there's something, there was an energy or something that I noticed. But I wanted to ask you, Aaron, you know, we talked about this the last time we were here with Amanda. You know, Cole has a certain empathy or sympathy for Jennifer Goines that I think we all kind of agreed may make Cassie a little, like,
uneasy,
sure. And now it kind of seemed like, oh, that maybe the tables have turned, and now
maybe it's some get back.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little.
Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on with them. He doesn't like it one bit. They definitely seem thick as thieves. And he knows the kind of guy that Deacon is, mm-hmm. that's for sure.
Does anyone really, though? I mean, peel the onion, Cole.
You're not that complicated. yeah, I, you know, he doesn't,
feel a song coming on.
He doesn't like it.
Sure, he doesn't like
He's
it.
He's definitely jealous, yeah.
All well, right.
You know, I think what the strength of any good show, and this is indeed a good show, is being able to kind of pull macro and micro, like these big, massive science fiction moves, and then intimate, small, interpersonal relationships. So like you don't care if the world's going to end if you don't care about the people, and it's these internal dramas that make us care about the people.
Sure. And so when they do splinter, they obviously go at separate times. You know, Cole, we find out, has been there for longer. But when Cassie lands in or arrives in 2044, she, you know, the sirens are going. And but we have this beautiful shot. We were just reviewing before we started recording, and we all kind of commented on it. But this beautiful shot of these buildings and all the power cutting out. So, Terry, I wanted to ask you, was that all post? Was that all digital like that? Because it looks
great. That was the work of a very talented special effects company called Folk. I believe she's just on a green screen. Wow. I think that's all we had in that shot. So the rest is completely constructed. They do an amazing
job.
It
was gorgeous. It was a beautiful shot. Cassie and Cole are reunited at the Emerson Hotel. Cole's been in 1944 for 2 months, and he kind of likes it. And I really, as an audience member and as a fan, kind of liked seeing Cole sort of in his element in a way. You know, I mean, obviously he can survive in 1980-something and 2016 and 2044, but he seemed like he was enjoying himself.
Yeah, he's been there long enough to get good and liquored up.
Right?
And he found himself a nice bespoke tailor.
Learned the word bespoke.
Yeah, he digs it. He definitely eases into the 1940s like a warm bath, and he
met some beautiful women in the Alumni Association.
Sure.
There's going to be a graphic
jewelry.
Novel where we'll write about that. Todd Stashrick is writing it as we speak.
Yes. Wonderful. I love that.
It was a perk of time traveling and showing up there, you know, for a period of time where you essentially don't have very much to do except enjoy yourself.
Sure. Well, and I liked how he actually says, try and have some fun.
Yeah.
And Cassie, of course, is just not having that.
The girl does not know how to loosen up.
No. Well...
Hey.
What?
Easy.
So, so Cassie has work to finish, and she says we have work to finish. So they get ready. They go to the party. Oh, this is another thing that I really enjoyed. So Cole in the hotel introduces Cassie as his wife. That's their cover. And then at the party, she introduces herself as his sister, which I was like, sick burn. That
Boom.
Was cold. That was so cold. So for our writers, man, you guys are making a point there with Cassie's character. I'm just saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was really difficult to sort of modulate that thing as to how much, because they do have a chemistry and they're two people who genuinely like each other, but, you know, they've butted heads and had this been at tremendous odds. So how much tension can you have between them and still be rooting for these people to be working together?
Yeah, and you don't want to make Cassie unlikable, but I think it's okay because I think she has a legitimate beef. Sure. You know, I think, you know, her fiance burned to death in front of her, and you know, she made that sacrifice. And
I get it. Cole keeps saving her life, and it inconveniences her in many ways. You know, so she definitely
but then she came
has
and
some
saved
firm
your
ground
ass
to
and killed
on.
All those guys on the roof. You know, so it's you know, it was something we were, because the great thing about Aaron and Amanda is just their chemistry, that they can pull off that back and forth without them being like, you're not like, oh God, get me away from these guys. You feel it, and Aaron's really good about taking it. Like he you see the frustration, and you also see the hurt. So it's not like he's not just mad. And the good thing about a conflict like that is you get to see him finally call it,
right.
You know, on her and be like, "What's your problem?"
Yeah,
you know, which he does later, and he finds out.
Sure. Yes, and I'm sure, and we will definitely discuss. So at the bar, Cole is getting a tasty beverage, and and this
just gets sponsored by.
He's a real control. Foodie,
Snapple.
You know, like pretty much every. It's like you know, he's like Anthony Bourdain at some point in every
time travel.
Yeah. Exactly. We should do that
this
webisode.
This burger, fantastic.
You know, found this little Chinese shop just up the street.
So, and we discussed, you know, Cole gets grilled for his beard. Now, but this gentleman, and I actually didn't write down his name. What is the name of the character who our police officer?
Agent Robert Gale.
Agent Gale.
Who is named after Bob Gale, the creator of Back to the Future.
Yes, indeed.
And
that
played by one of my favorite actors of all time, Jay Carnes.
He was great.
Who is, you may know him as Dutch on The Shield, one of the great television shows of all time.
Consummate gentleman.
I was such a fan of him, and I remember saying to the casting, I'm like, I mean, what I really want is Jay Carnes. I just wish he would do it. And they're like, well, have you thought about asking Jay Carnes?
That helps.
Like, oh no, I could never ask him to be. And it was great having.
We're only an edgy cable show. Why would he want to do that?
he was such a gentleman, and let me be a complete fanboy and ask him about The Shield for hours upon hours.
Well, I'm sure he enjoyed that. So, so Agent Gale is given a little side eye to Cole, and Cole's not having it. But meanwhile, Cassie spots the messenger with Dr. Crawford, and that spells trouble. So she goes and pulls Cole. And then, you know, as we return, we find Dr. Crawford is bound, and, you know, Cassie and Cole are trying to, you know, prevent his murder. I actually, y'all got me. You guys really got me, because when she stabbed him, I was like, oh my God, they didn't get there. They didn't make it. Like I really bought into that. So good job. That's just a little pat on the back for you guys.
Thanks.
Because you fooled me. But we of course learn that he's not the primary. He's not the person. They have the wrong person with the same name.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Yeah, I mean, that was some logistics we figured out in the room. Mike Sussman took the lead on this script, and just figuring all that twisty out was complicated.
It was fun, though. I liked it. So after, you know, the messengers kind of split, and then Cole and Cassie arrive upstairs, but they notice this framed drawing.
Well, that's not all they notice.
Oh, what? Tell me. What did I miss?
Well, there are flower petals.
Oh, yes.
Jasmine
and lavender.
The flowers.
Which we've seen before.
Yeah. Now, let's dive into this, because this comes back and we've seen before. So can you remind our audience?
Well, we know that this is some ritualistic thing with the Army of the Twelve Monkeys, that they are... feels connected with nature, and certainly flower petals have a plague thing. You know, they used to, back in the day, would mask the smell of plague. So
ring around the rosy,
exactly. So the first time we saw it was with our pallid man last year, Tom Noonan, who we last saw consumed by a paradox.
Right.
So it is clearly connected to their ritual.
And it could have a very personal meaning for him, too.
It could.
Yeah.
It could.
True.
Interesting. I wonder, let's file that away for later. So I'm glad that we, and actually for you guys, was that, you know, aside from the masking, the death and things like that, historically, was that ritual, is that actually where you guys got it, or was it something more specific?
Initially. Yeah. Okay. Initially it was, you know, what's scarier than Tom Noonan spreading flowers around his body and saying he's going to kill and threatening to kill you and your family.
That's scary.
So that's where that comes from.
Lovely. So we'll probably be seeing that again. So we noticed the drawing of the monkey, and that sort of is a big hint. But before we get there, we figure out what that symbol is and what that hint is. We shoot back to 2044, and Ramsay is spending time with his son, and then the son leaves, and Ramsay and Jones have some real talk. And this scene, I love this scene. This is a great scene, and I love it because I think with any good, complicated show, you can see the side of both arguments. You can, you know what I mean? Like you can, when Jones was laying out her argument, and by the way, further, I'm Team Jones. So I, in Walking Dead, if it was Team Shane or Team Rick, I was Shane. I was Team Shane. I was like, no, I'd be that guy. So, so in this case, Jones basically says like, look, you know, you selfishly are okay with all of these people dying because of, you know, your child. Mm-hmm. And then I love how Ramsay kind of shoots right back and says, well, you only want to save them selfishly.
Yeah. It's like, you know, two gods having a conversation or debate about something because, you know, they both have this tremendous power or have used this power in a way to their advantage. And they're sort of debating the moral merits of everything that this show's about. So, I mean, ever since we sent Ramsay back in season one and he became part of the 12 Monkeys, and then to bring him back, it's like you're chomping at the bit to get a whack at those scenes where these characters reconfront each other after they've done these major things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, stuff like that, you know, in the show, it may be a minute or something, mm-hmm. but we could probably have like 10 pages of it and just keep going.
We often
going.
Do.
Yeah.
And it's hard to cut back as many, many great things end up on the floor. But it also is to see these actors pull it off. Mm-hmm. I mean, Barbara, you can give any monologue on a plan. I mean, she could read Cat in the Hat and it would be riveting. That's an argument we needed to hear. Mm-hmm. Too. We needed to understand Ramsay's point of view. We needed to address that he's not off the hook for last season.
Yeah. And I think that was important because as a fan and as a viewer, we like Ramsay again. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We've spent enough time, at least I do, maybe not everybody does, but we've spent enough time with him to outside of the 12 Monkeys and his role within the 12 Monkeys where I'm like, but I like that guy and that's Cole's best friend and like he's not a bad guy.
I mean, things change very rapidly in our world, and, you know, you want to have these characters come back together even if they've had these terrible fights and so on and so forth, but we'd be cheating the audience if we just sort of, like, glazed over these major, major animosities that they would
dynamics,
have with each other.
It's exactly. Deacon, the sociopath, is now living with them and seems to be part of this mission. You have to open up with Cole and him beating the shit out of each other.
Sure.
And this conversation with Jones and Ramsay, he cannot be off the hook. She has to be like, if you die, that's not my problem.
Yeah, and
I want to address this sociopath thing. I think the only reason he's a sociopath is he hasn't killed nearly as many people as Ramsay's responsible for and Jones is responsible for, but he just doesn't feel the remorse that they feel.
Exactly.
I'd always like.
So he's the monster.
Deacon in the room, it was always saying that, like, you know, he's just a product of his environment. Like,
thank you.
If he lived in like 2015, he'd be like a great attorney or like a great pub. Realtor or something, like, you know, and he wouldn't have to kill anybody.
He wouldn't own a pub.
He would be a serial murderer of children.
Yeah.
Something no, he would have been lines. Like
your a, brain right to that.
Like a car salesman, like a cutthroat.
You'd be a fry cook on Venus.
Sure.
Right, exactly.
Yes. Well, it's a great scene, and I also really liked how Jones kind of trumps him and says, "Well, my selfish act saves billions of people, and your selfish act is a." And I was like, "Man, snap."
Fair point.
Yeah, it is a good point. Okay, so Ramsay's put on notice. Like, look, if Deacon kills you, not my problem. I didn't do it. So
West we, 7 Justice.
Yeah, right. So we go back to 1944. Detective. I don't want to get his rank wrong. Agent.
Agent
I don't
Gale.
Want to insult him. He's worked very hard. So Agent Gale suspects Cole and Cassie for this murder. Let's see. And then Cole and Cassie, meanwhile, figure out that Thomas Crawford Jr. is in a mental institution. So Thomas,
the real target.
Exactly. And that's the real target. So Cole figures out that they killed the wrong person. So now everybody's on the same page. But in this sort of situation, we have this really interesting conversation between Cole and Cassie about, you know, Cole has to explain to Cassie again, Jennifer is not just crazy. She, you know, and then Cassie kind of says, oh, because she's special. Like, it's this really heated, tough conversation. And now we get to the part about her fiance, Aaron, you know, dying, and Cole kind of let it, you know. So, Aaron, can you talk a little bit about this scene? Because this is a big scene for your characters.
She's really lashing out at him in that scene and hitting him with whatever she can dredge up, basically. And, you know, she touches a nerve. It's a weight he carries around. He feels very guilty that he got her involved in this, and he feels responsible for what's happened to her and what she's become. So that's sort of, you know, the argument takes a radical turn at that point. It's no longer two people just spitting things at each other. It becomes a real moment of communication when he says to her, like, do you think I don't know how much I've cost you? You know, it's a nice moment.
Do you remember the other version of that scene that the audience will never see?
We did one that you wanted us to just keep on going with.
It was one of the few moments where we had a little extra time. And I said, I want you guys to just go for it. I want you to go places, just go to different places. And actually, some of that is what we used.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, some of, like, there are pieces of this. It was a more intense version. And but then they went, when they got off book, it was very interesting to see the other darker, much considerably darker version of this scene that totally could have been. And it was much longer and much, oh my God. And Aaron was brilliant. Do you remember where you did?
I don't remember.
Went?
No. What?
You basically, she kept hitting you with Aaron. And then you finally looked at her and you said, Aaron deserved to die.
That's the way of looking at it. I got to be honest.
And it was dark. It was cold. He's like, he had it coming. And then she, and Amanda, I took Amanda back. So it was such a beautifully honest moment. I love that when we can get that on set. But then the problem was we needed them to get to a place where they could still go on the mission.
Yeah,
but the scene was just like, literally they looked at each other and
there was
and
no
Cole,
coming back.
Cole looks at her and Aaron, rightly so, was the proper end of that scene, turned and walked out of the room. It was like, oh, we can't use it because we'd need another scene to get
right,
them back.
Right.
But it was brilliant. And these two are just phenomenal actors. And the fact that they can go to these places so quickly is a huge asset to the show.
Sure. And also, you know, I don't know, Amanda's not here to weigh in, but it was interesting to me that this character Aaron came up again, because I really don't like him now. You know what I mean? Like, as an audience member, I did not like that he decided for Cassie in season one what was going to happen for her. I know he thought he was trying to protect her, but as an audience member, I was furious at him. And so that crossed the line for me, like him physically trying to shove her into a car with the 12 monkeys because he knows better. So actually, I'm kind of on Cole's side on this.
I think who knows what anyone would really do in a situation where they're facing an apocalypse.
Sure.
You may be like, for my family to survive, I have to make some crazy deal that I never have thought that's so inhuman, but I love my family. And again, I think that's Ramsay's thing.
Yep.
You know, everybody's does Jones's this in the show.
Thing.
Jones, they all do it for love. So I understand, Aaron. I don't condone what he did. But I get him.
And I wonder, I will ask Amanda this the next time I see her, if she thinks Cassie present, like current incarnation of Cassie, like badass take no prisoners Cassie, would have time for character Aaron and his shenanigans. Yeah. You're shaking your head.
Me thinks not.
Yep. Sean shaking his head.
No. I mean, I think for us too, was that moment when he'd been so supportive and so understanding in the face of this craziness. And he did, take the choice out of her hands, and that was sort of the breaking point.
Yeah.
But I mean, like the cool stuff, for Aaron in season one was like really showing like someone who was just breaking down because of they had this, the Cassandra complex, this terrible, truth, this knowledge that the future was going to end. And Terry's got family, I've got family. It's like you probably are like, we're heading to the hills, screw everybody else, we're taking care of us. And it's a dual thing.
And as you all know, I have not seen any more than essentially what we're talking about today, and I still think character Aaron's coming back. This is my fan theory. So we'll see.
You're not alone.
We'll see.
People think that, but we often do the opposite of what people
think. That's also true. You guys are smarter than me. That's for sure. All right. So that was
definitely not true.
That was a bit of a tangent, but important, I think. So, okay. Cole, let's see. Tommy Crawford, he's in the asylum. He's drawn the Red Forest. He's got the monkeys on the... He's drawn the monkeys on the wall. He's picked the lock. And Cole explains about... figures out the primary... Or talks about the primary issue. And he also... he kind of figures out that maybe the plague isn't the whole shebang. Maybe there's more to this. Which we later find out is absolutely true.
Yes.
Man, when did you guys decide for our writers?
Season one.
Really?
Yeah. We always knew it. In order for this show to have legs, and awesome, I just wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see time travelers versus time travelers. And I wanted to see this mysterious organization where you're not sure what the hell they want. And that this plague is definitely important to them. But why?
Yeah.
And so we knew we started up. That's why the episode 6 of the Red Forest, and you start hearing a lot more from Olivia. There's something else going on here. We knew for a while.
Yeah, I mean it's a tall order to have a plague that kills most of the people on the planet be a secondary threat.
Right.
What's worse than that? And, certainly going that to in that territory, we had to have something sort of bigger and larger than life that you typically see. It's sort of a new sci-fi concept.
And I think you get that when you hang around Tom Noonan and Allison Down in that weird mansion and the way they speak and having a cycle, a plan of 12 babies and something bigger is going on than just... Let's just kill a bunch of people.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, going forward, I definitely have my own questions about the bigger picture. But for now, we're in the asylum. The messengers are there. Cole and Cassie are there. And the lady messenger, what is her name? Do we know?
Scotty. We call her Mantis. But that is a writer's room name. We call her that because we sort of viewed her moving like a praying mantis, and she does.
Yeah,
like, she took that into her the way her head cocks back and forth. So that's what
I call her creepy stunning.
Creepy stunning. Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah.
She is creepy and stunning in this role. So, Mantis / creepy stunning takes Cole hostage, straps him in, and starts torturing him, which is not good. And then Tommy and Cassandra, meanwhile, are together, and Tommy knows Cassandra's name, and we learn he's primary. And he knows, I'm going to be killed today. This is my job. This is my purpose. So Cassie and Tommy go to confront Mantis. I don't want to spoil anything. I just want to be sure.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
Yeah.
You have bigger questions.
No, but...
That go into the next episode.
Which I'm not going to do.
Which anyone who watches this episode should.
So, at that point, as they go to confront them, you guys keep the suspense going. You take us back to 2044. Deacon swoops in and...
Swooper.
He takes Ramsey in the middle of, takes him into the middle of nowhere.
Little Miller's Crossing.
Yep. And the forest starts to turn into the Red Forest.
Why were you driving him so far? I don't think you needed to go that far.
Jones clearly wasn't going to be mad.
I just say the words.
Exactly. So Jones would probably hand you the gun. And be like, Cole just clean it up later.
You know what? I think, again, I think if you're asking me what my reasons for that was because...
Because the writers don't have one.
I liked the fact that to have him suffer, to have him sit through it,
that's
to have him contemplate it so that I could monologize in the back seat and make him live through this and suck on it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, dig his own grave. Yeah, make him suffer through it.
Not a sociopath, just a product of...
My environment. A tough dad. My dad would do that, probably. Yeah, you probably have to stay. No, not my dad, but Deacon's dad. Probably made him suffer through things.
Yeah.
Probably forced him to,
get the switch.
I'm saying. I think that's probably accurate.
So, but something that I found very interesting at the end of this scene after the forest changes and this third person who's with Deacon and Ramsey gets... What would you call that?
Gets caught in an anomaly.
Yes, he does. And it is gnarly.
Temporal time anomaly.
He sure does. And it's gross and scary. But Ramsey sort of saves Deacon in a way.
It does.
Which...
Heart of gold on that one.
I mean...
He's trying to do make up for $7 billion. Yeah. The guy's got a guilty conscience.
That, and I think he hates Deacon, but whatever just happened to that guy, that's not fair.
Well,
you know what? There was some lines in there that didn't make it in the final cut, but it was like Deacon sitting there seeing what just happened to that guy. I looked at Ramsey and I go, just shoot me.
Yeah.
Like, I do not want to die like that. Yeah. So just get it over with. And then he chooses to save me.
Yeah.
Because he's a sweetheart.
He's got a deep caramel hole to climb out
of. He does.
Deep caramel hole. What a great title.
He goes home and he's like,
just one.
Today I saved one.
Well, so actually for our writers, I have a question because I have written down here. We see the Red Forest sort of overtaking and everybody, since season one, we've seen the Red Forest. Everybody from the 12 Monkeys is talking about the Red Forest. So can you guys explain, is the Red Forest, are we to believe that's sort of like paradise or nirvana or something like that?
Well, maybe for them.
Maybe for them that they
want to bring this thing to life or to death, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
It
serves a function to them.
Yes.
It serves a function to know.
Which we'll learn about.
Okay, that's a good, concise answer.
Also, we know that distortion of time, we've established a million times, turns green to red, the leaves and foliage to red. So the Red Force is really a product of a huge distortion in time and space.
Sure. So back in 1944, we have this. I know that this is not the reference, but I was thinking of Bridge of Spies, the Bridge of Spies moment where they're basically swapping their hostages.
Yeah, yeah.
But as
Bridge, the hallway of spies,
the hall of spies, exactly. But as Cole and Tommy pass each other, Tommy says, "Remember, James, the only failure is giving up." Yeah. And I thought to myself, isn't that Cole's dad's line?
It is.
Okay. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Well, I mean,
it's Tommy is connected to all of this. He can see Cole and his importance. He can see Cassie and her importance. He can see Jennifer, who's primary. So he's connected to time. And I thought that that was a powerful statement for Cole to hear something about from his father, you know, this little bit of hope that was offered to Cole.
Okay.
But it's not like that Tommy's related to his father or anything that, but that it's this guy knows that this was something that was said to Cole and it was important for Cole to hear. And Cole is definitely on a journey this year in which that is an important sentiment.
And Aaron, for you, when this guy who you know is primary, you know that means something, and he says these words to your character, I mean, I don't know, because there's no time for dialogue. There's not time to react.
No,
really.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a moment of shock.
Yeah.
Where is that coming? Just same reaction you had, basically. Like, what is that? Where is that coming from? How can he possibly know?
Yeah.
That's a connection to me, and just the sense that. As Terry said, this person is, there's something special going on here. There's something important happening that we don't quite understand.
Yeah. I'm excited to sort of dive into this a little bit more as the season goes on. So
well, next episode, you get a healthy dose of answers.
We sure do.
And new questions.
So if you're listening, come back next week. Okay, so the last thing that happens is, you know, instead of letting Cassie save him, Tommy says, nope, I'm going with this lady because it's, you know, I kept flashing back to Jennifer Goines and her purpose, my purpose, what's my purpose?
Yeah.
And I guess, are we to believe that Tommy thinks that this is his purpose?
Yeah.
Well,
it's just fated to happen. It's immovable. So it's part of the big cycle.
Sure.
Whatever that is. And maybe that's okay for him.
Maybe.
You know, maybe that this is his death will be more meaningful to our heroes and get them to a place closer to success. Although it doesn't seem like it now.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, as that moment happens, the messenger or Mantis, Lux, herself and Tommy in this room. And Cole says to Cassie, you know, the paradox, like he figures that she says she's got a bone knife, you know, from his bones. And so they know something bad is about to happen above somebody just getting killed. And sure enough, we get a paradox.
You sure do.
We sure
do. And you see its repercussions.
Yes.
Break through time and
new
find
level,
it.
New level of paradox, right?
This point. It's not the blue sort of object paradox we saw last year. That this is something much, much more powerful. It's red. It's connected to time. It's almost as if it's using time to destroy time. So we'll learn more.
We will. And the police enter. Agent Gale enters. Cole and Cassie are knocked out. And
that's the end.
That's all she wrote. So no answers this week.
Nope.
But tune in next week.
Next week, they're in a pickle, aren't they?
They sure
are. They're stuck back there. Who's going to come to their rescue?
Oh, boy. I can't wait to find out.
What's going on with primaries and paradoxes? Will Cole and Cassie ever get along? Is Deacon okay?
Only 3 episodes in.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, this is great.
We're off.
I feel very good about this.
So do we.
All right. Good. Good. So I feel like I should, you know, like Jerry Springer, have some final thoughts, but I have no final thoughts.
Well, it's difficult with that kind of cliffhanger.
It is.
Yeah.
But I think y'all did that on purpose.
We did.
Yeah. Because you want us to watch. All right. Well, we will.
All right,
done, deal.
Everybody tune in next week.
Yes, and so for our listeners, before we say goodbye, if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to it. Wherever you are listening right now, there is probably a way for you to subscribe, or you can just do it the good old-fashioned way on iTunes. And speaking of iTunes, don't be afraid to rate and review. If you rate and review the podcast, it puts it into other people's timelines and feeds and all those things, and
eye
so
holes.
And their eye holes and their ear holes. And so that's good because more people will listen and we'll get more Talking Monkeys. And for more 12 Monkeys madness, be sure to visit sci-fi.com. So, gentlemen, where can everybody find you on the interwebs?
My Twitter handle is at Aaron A. Stanford.
I'm at Todd Stashwick, 2 D's.
Sean, are you on social media?
At Sean _ Tretta.
And I'm at Terry Metallis.
Lovely. And I am at Clark Wolf, Clark with an E, Wolf with an E. Guys, thank you all so much for taking time out of your day to chat. This was super fun.
Thank you.
And we will see you all next week.
Next week.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Ciao.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.